Red is feeling sick, so I think he will listen to the recording. I don't know whether we should do an epitaph. But it reminded me of my dog, so I thought, let's just look at it, page 526. Useful to have, and to know what William Watson thought. So his friends he loved, his direst earthly foes, cats. I believe he did but feign to hate. My hand will miss the insinuated nose, mine eyes the tail that wagged contempt at fate. So, yeah, poor doggy. But he was okay. He wagged contempt at fate, and he didn't really hate cats. So, what? Yeah, does Quincy hate cats?
No, he doesn't hate
cats. No, see? What more could you want in a dog? Really. Okay, so we've done one poet for today. As I say, we won't be doing Wild, but Jeff will. But a bunch of things are... So we're getting to the 20th century, and influence of these poets on 20th century poets and on even, let's just say, post-World War II poets is getting to be pretty strong. We're kind of at the interface of Victorianism and the modern age, even though, as we've been saying in this class throughout, Victorianism is a kind of interface between pre-industrial and industrial economies and histories and cultures. But now we're getting to, you could call it the interface of the interface. We're going to look at a couple of Kipling poems today. And Kipling is basically so canceled that he's almost never, ever, ever taught anywhere except as evil. And that's not actually quite right. He is both really interesting and important in the history of English poetry. George Orwell called him something like the best bad poet ever. And that's not quite fair because he's more than a bad poet. He's actually a really good poet. He won the Nobel Prize largely for his poetry, but also for his fiction. And his short stories are amazing. I won't quite say the same about his novels, but his short stories are amazing. And his attitudes are totally wrong and totally self. They're complacent, but they were actually pretty radical. Obviously not anti-colonialist in the slightest, nevertheless pretty radical compared to the standard colonialism of his time, let's put it that way. There are a couple of reasons to do Kipling, one of which is to see that he is not his reputation. His reputation isn't entirely or even largely wrong, but it isn't entirely or even largely right either. And so that's something that we should talk about. But let's quickly look at the Robert Bridges poem, London Snow, which is page 523. Let me just ask the way we did last time, were there any poems that particularly grabbed anyone for this week? Yeah.
There was a Kipling poem, The Gentleman Rankers.
Yeah, which became the Yale drinking song. Gentlemen songsters out on a spree, and the title, From Here to Eternity, a novel, a World War II novel, also a movie, comes from that as well. So did you like that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good. All right, let's look at London Snow. And we won't go through it carefully, but it's really interesting as another example of sprung rhythm, but a far less obvious one. So Bridges and Hopkins. So So here, quick. Potential question for the exam, just quick review. Sprung rhythm is associated with whom? In stress? No. Hopkins. So sprung rhythm is when you have that boom, boom, boom of stressed syllables in a line with the unstressed syllables not actually being counted. So you just get Hopkins clotting up those stressed syllables, and Hopkins is just so interested in stress. He and Bridges were close friends, and Bridges published Hopkins' work after he died, after Hopkins died. And Bridges is an important minor figure, not only as a poet, but in the history of English poetry, as a promoter of English poetry. And he, as I say, he published a lot of Hopkins after Hopkins died. Hopkins had mixed feelings about this poem, London Snow, mixed feelings about it formally. That is to say, he thought it was a great poem, but whether it really counted as sprung rhythm, he wasn't sure. And so, as I say, Bridges had a much more relaxed view of sprung rhythm. But again, it's stresses that count in a line of poetry. And it's probably appropriate that in a poem about snow in London, which is rare, and was rare even back then, it's probably appropriate that in a poem about snow in London, you don't have a pounding of sprung rhythm. It's hard to imagine Hopkins saying, snow, snow, ah, all the snow falling down, down, unselving me with its snow, unless it's a blizzard. But this is not a poem about a blizzard. It's a poem about a snowfall. I wouldn't even call it a snowstorm, I don't think, but a snowfall that leaves everything seeming peaceful. And it's just by way of a little bit of practice in the lots of different experiments of poetic meter, poetic rhyme, poetic form that the Victorians were engaged in. The history of English poetry is a history of debates about form. And Bridges himself wrote a book about Milton's prosody. People know that Paradise Lost is written in blank verse, and that Milton thought, although wrongly, that it was the first long English poem that wasn't a play. So blank verse, obviously Shakespeare wrote in blank verse, there's Marlowe wrote in blank verse, people were doing blank verse dramas, but if you were publishing a poem, it always rhymed in England, with a couple of exceptions that Milton didn't know about, translations mainly from Latin blank verse. Milton thought that Paradise Lost, as he said, was a recovery of an ancient style of poetry from what he calls modern bondage, the modern bondage of rhyme. And Milton was really, really intent on showing what could be done with iambic pentameter blank verse. And Bridges thought that what Milton was doing, he called a fiction. That is that Milton wrote the way he wrote in order to claim that you could do blank verse the way he did, but it required a whole lot of Miltonic stretching of stress and of where stress should go in lines and so forth. So I'm just saying that whether Bridges is right or not, and he's at least partially right, but maybe not more than partially right, this is a way of saying that the history of English poetry, really from the beginning of the 16th century to right now, is a history, among other things, of a debate about poetic form and changes in poetic form. And those changes actually lead to changes in capacity to be receptive to different kinds of form. This is true in music as well. You know, the reason that your parents can't understand why you think what you're listening to is music is because they were brought up on different kinds of music, and they can't hear what you're hearing. They haven't internalized the kind of experience of music, of harmony or dissonance, of timing, of rhythm, and so on. They can't experience it because they haven't internalized cerebrally, that is, their brains are wired differently. What happens as you learn things is your brain gets wired in one way or another. The same is true of English poetry. So that what didn't sound like iambic pentameter, for example, to Milton's contemporaries, now does sound like iambic pentameter to us because we've internalized Milton. But once you stop thinking of poetry as iambic pentameter, you get open to different possibilities of hearing things as having form, not just being formless, the way a lot of people will say, why do you call this poetry? It just seems like prose with ragged line endings. And to some people it does, but as you internalize the way line endings work, you start feeling its poetic power. Anyhow, this is it's a whole history of English poetry, is a history of English receptiveness, English language receptiveness to what poetic form can be like. And Bridges, like Hopkins, was really interested in that. So just to notice about this poem is that some lines are much longer than other lines, but they do, and they all rhyme. And a lot of those rhymes are gerunds, that is, fly. Do people know what that is, what a gerund is?
It's a verb made into a noun.
Yeah, so, and a gerundive is a verb made into an adjective. They're related to each other. So if you say, lying is always bad, what you're doing is you're taking the verb to lie and turning it into a noun and making it the subject of a sentence. If you call someone a lying fool, then you are taking the verb and turning it into an adjective. They are, what kind of fool are they? They're a lying fool. So lots of those in this poem. When men were all asleep, the snow came flying in large white flakes falling on the city brown. So if you can just hear what he's doing there, which is, when men were all asleep, the snow came flying. And that is pretty iambic. Da 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 da. Do you hear that? When men were all asleep, the snow came flying. But then you get the description of the snow. In large white flakes fall. So notice that you get four stresses in a row there. So that's Bridges's version of those stresses in Hopkins. Can you quote a Hopkins line with lots of stresses? Not to put you on the spot or anything.
It will flash out like shining from shook foil.
Okay.
That's not maybe the most stressed one.
Yeah, so...
Probably a better one.
Yeah, no, but that's a good one. All is, same poem, God's grandeur. And all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil. So you can hear those stresses. All is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil. And you can't really get away from those stresses. One thing actors will do is that they will find a way not to stress syllables that are ordinarily stressed. And you get some meaning out of that. You get that a lot in Shakespeare. But to take a line from Yeats, which I don't think we talked about in this class, but Yeats in what might be his last poem, probably isn't, but very close to the end, goes over the poetry he's written earlier in his life. We're going to do Yeats on Wednesday in this class, but he goes over the poetry he's written earlier in his life, and he talks about Cuchulainn and how Cuchulainn engaged in vain gaiety, vain battle, vain repose. And if it's a great line, vain gaiety, vain battle, vain repose. And if you hear it, do you hear what happens to the word vain in that line? Vain gaiety, vain battle, vain repose. So it's the first two veins are unstressed in the meter of the line. Vain gaiety, vain battle. But it's not vain repose, it's vain repose. So what's happened to the word vain is it goes from being unstressed, you know, it's got the same volume, physical. If you did it on an oscilloscope, if you looked at it on your computer, if you did a recording of it and looked at the amplitude of the waves, the veins would be the same each time. You couldn't pick those words out. But it's vain gaiety, and the gay in gaiety is more stressed than vain, which it's also almost rhymes with. So you feel that you're going up. Vain gaiety, vain battle. And then you get vain repose. And so the third vein gets stressed by the line. Even though the volume, the length of the syllables and so on, no one actually knows scientifically what stress is. People have tried to figure it out with machines and they can't. But it's something that the brain can do. And everything about those three veins are the same except what surrounds them. And that is a way of talking about the relation of stress to the metrical substrate that sets up expectations for which syllables will be stressed and which won't. And when you get a kind of tension between expectation and stress, you get something interesting. And that's what Shakespearean actors really, really like, is coming upon those tensions. That's what performers of metrical poetry really, really like, is coming upon those tensions. So here, what Hopkins is doing when he talks about how all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, he's preventing you from actualizing that as, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil. You can't do it because of the similarity of the words just clotted, pushed up right next to each other. So Bridges is kind of doing, using the same mode to do something opposite, which is, when men were all asleep, the snow came flying in large white flakes falling on the city brown. And you're not supposed to think, oh, boom, 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 large white flakes. But it's rather, you want it to follow a kind of iambic, the default iambic pattern, an iambic contour, but he slows it down. So Hopkins tends to speed up when he does sprung rhythm. Bridges here slows it down in large white flakes falling. So four stresses in a row, but they don't feel like stresses. They feel like, well, they're stressed, but they kind of shouldn't really be, so we have to slow it down and say it softly. And then the word falling does that for you. So it's in large white flakes falling on the. So notice three unstressed syllables. Falling on the. And that's like the snow falling. Okay, can people hear that? It's a beautiful thing. Minor but beautiful and worth sensitizing yourself to. And Bridges is really good at that. Stealthily and perpetually settling and loosely lying. So these lines are really beautifully descriptive of their own meter, which is something that poetic lines shouldn't always be. There are reasons not to do that, but something that lines should sometimes be. And that's what he's doing here. Hushing the latest traffic of the. So notice traffic of the drowsy town. Deadening, muffling, stifling its murmurs, failing. Lazily and in. You hear that? Lazily and in. Again, Lee and in, three unstressed syllables, incessantly floating down and down, silently sifting and veiling road, roof, and railing. And just having falling where it is in the second line is putting a gerundive, which you may be expecting by now at the end of the line. He's also putting it in the middle of the line. So a way of thinking about Bridges, you know, occasionally people take my classes and then they get corrupted into spending the rest of their lives on poetic meter. And I think that's great. It's something worth thinking about all your life. Not the only thing you should think about all your life, but a thing worth thinking about all your life. Like thinking about the dancing of bees, thinking about poetic meter is a really good thing too. It'll last you all your life in thought. And one way maybe of distinguishing Bridges and Hopkins, and it's what Hopkins criticized Bridges for, and Hopkins is infinitely the better poet. I mean, it's not the greater poet. It's not like, okay, two sides of the same coin. They're not. Hopkins is the face of the platinum trillion-dollar coin, and Bridges is the reverse side, the tail side of a wooden nickel in comparison. But still, they are two sides of a coin. And what Hopkins is doing is clotting and putting the stresses, the in-stress, together in his lines. What Bridges is doing, in a sense, is getting as many unstressed syllables together as he can. And that's what Hopkins didn't like about the poem is, you say this is sprung rhythm, but why all these unstressed syllables making these lines so long with these unstressed syllables? But in a sense, that's the point. It's that the unstressed syllables, they're like the snow falling. They're what gives this a sense of peacefulness. And it's, you know, a beautiful thing to compare and contrast with Hopkins. It's a pretty wonderful poem. Okay, let us go. I wanted to look at a couple of poems by Amy Levy on page 529. Rick's only has two poems by her. So she was the second Jewish woman to go to Cambridge. The first to go to her college in Cambridge. You know, the Cambridge is divided into different colleges. She also wrote a novel, which is still read and taught today, about the experience of being a Jewish woman in Victorian England. She had a hard life. She committed suicide at the age of 27. And she was temperamentally given to despair. And then what made things worse for her is that she started going deaf in her mid-20s. And that just made things harder and harder. So she was, you know, she was alienated in various ways as a woman in a male literary culture. You know, not as male as it used to be, but still, as a Jewish woman in a Christian culture. But she was admired by both Wilde and Yeats. So they liked her poetry and thought she could have become, might have eventually become a really, really good poet, but she died young. And I think you can, if you look at her poem called Epitaph, which is not about a dog, it's, well, let's just read it. So, Eileen, you weren't here last week, so it's your turn.
Okay. On a commonplace person who died in bed. This is the end of him. Here he lies, the dust in his throat, the worm in his eyes, the mold in his mouth, the turf on his breast. This is the end of him. This is the best. He will never lie on his couch awake, wide-eyed, tearless, till dim daybreak. Never again will he smile and smile when his heart is breaking all the while. He will never stretch out his hands in vain, groping and groping, never again. Never ask for bread, get a stone instead. Never pretend that the stone is bread. Never sway and sway twixt the false and true, weighing and noting the long hours through. Never ache and ache with the choked up sighs. This is the end of him. Here he lies.
Great, thank you. Okay, so what do we know about him?
He's dead.
We know he's dead, yes.
He was miserable when he lived.
Yeah. He was miserable when he lived, and what did that misery consist in?
He was poor, probably.
Okay. And just say where you get that.
Well, I mean, you talk about his hand would never stretch out again in vain to ask for bread.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
That could be a nod to... Because that's in the Bible. Like, who among you would ask for, you know, their father... Like, if your child asked you for bread, would you give them a stone?
Yes.
So it could be who that. Among you would... That was also maybe, like, begging, but I think it's also... It could just be a metaphor.
Yeah. So what is the evidence that it's a metaphor? There's the elusive evidence.
Yeah.
What's the metaphor? What's the evidence in the poem that it's a metaphor? I think this is a 2 on a scale of 1 to 5.
The next line that says to not pretend the stone is bread?
Yeah, so, and how does that show it's a metaphor?
Is it suggesting that in the previous line, there, like, you were pretending that the stone is bread?
Well, you who gave him the stone, you mean?
No, like the receiver.
Okay, so in real life, can you imagine a situation, you know, without some whole movie like The Sting setting it up for you? Well, what I'm going to do is pretend this stone that you gave me is bread so that they'll all follow me because they'll be hungry, they'll want the bread, but ha ha, I'm just pretending it's bread, but it's really a stone. And when they finally say, give us that bread, I'll give them the stone. In the meantime, you will have escaped with the bread. And that'll be really good. And why is it so important to escape with the bread? I don't know. But you would have to come up with some scenario. But in real life, if you beg for bread and someone gives you a stone, is there any real life context where the person who gets the stone is going to pretend it's bread?
No.
is going to genuinely pretend, not say, oh, thank you for the bread, which is not pretending. It's being sarcastic. It's pretending to pretend. But in real life, does anyone ever pretend that a stone is bread?
Probably no, but I was thinking about it more like the fairy tale where I think the little girl who sells matches. Sort
of, yeah, she's about the little match girl. Yeah.
Yeah, be frozen to death, and she's, you know, lighting up the matches and thinking, oh, what if I have a house, you know? And,
yeah.
This and for here is like, oh, I get a stone, but you know, let's just imagine this is bread.
Yeah. Okay. So it would be like, do people know the sucking stones passage in Molloy? I'm guessing not. So Beckett's Molloy is his first novel he wrote in French, first novel he published in French. It's hilarious, it's wonderful, it's life-changing, you should read it. But there is a very famous, you can actually find this on YouTube because the Irish actor Patrick McGowan did it on YouTube, where Molloy, who's starving, will suck stones in order to try and get his appetite to go down. And it's a hilarious and deep and wonderful section. So, yeah, you might do that, like the little match girl. You might fantasize about that. But, okay, these nevers... What do they mean about what his life was like? This is maybe a way into this question. So, where's the first use of the word never?
Never again will
be
someone
sorry.
No, it's
actually, there's
he'll
a use.
He'll never lie on his couch awake.
Okay, so he will never lie on his couch awake. What does that tell you about what his life was like? So, okay, that's future tense. He will never do this. Mm-hmm. And then in the next line, never again will he do this. But he will never do this. The never, like any negative, is contrasting with the with the assertion. The negation is contrasting with the assertion. If you say, it's not yet time to leave class, then... what the assertion would be is, okay, class is over, it's time to leave. So what is the opposite that is being negated by the line, he will never lie on his couch awake? This is 1.1 out of 5. He will never lie on his couch awake, as opposed to...
He will lie on his couch awake.
I don't think it's as opposed to he will.
But he did
that a lot.
Yeah.
Often.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He often.
Yeah. So the contrast with the future here is the imperfect. Do people know what the imperfect is? Spanish speakers versus the perfect tense? Okay, you need to know this about grammar.
He was doing something.
Right. Imperfect is things like, I was driving when. Perfect is I drove. And you don't say, I drove when a deer ran across the road. It's I was driving and a deer ran across the road. So the imperfect is you're doing something that is either takes a while to do, and you are describing a kind of past tense version of the present tense experience. When I was a student at Brandeis, you're describing a period of your life. And it's a period of your life that you feel that you are describing as something that unfolds in a series of present tenses. So imperfect literally means not completed in the account that I'm giving. I was having trouble falling asleep. Doesn't mean you lay down in bed and you immediately said, I can't sleep. Because then you're not having trouble. Then you're just asserting, I don't feel like sleeping or whatever. But if you're having trouble falling asleep, it means it took a while. And what you're describing by saying I was having trouble falling asleep is a period of time. So the imperfect, if you're doing it in, if you're learning Latin or Greek or French, or I assume Spanish, but maybe not, when you're taught to translate the imperfect as either I was or I used to. So he used to live in New York. is not, yes, he transported from the Starship Enterprise into New York for a single second, took a breath, and then transported back. That, yes, he was alive in New York for a single sentence, for a single second. That's true. But he didn't used to live there. So was is a kind of broader context saying this is the way things used to be. And you don't say, oh, it used to be the case that the book hit the floor. Okay, that happened once. And even if it didn't happen once, it's not a state of things. So the imperfect is describing a state of things before the present. What page was that?
529.
Yeah, my book was falling to the floor and making a sound. Thank you. So what's partly interesting about this is that the future here, he will never lie on his couch awake, tells you what his past was like, which was?
He lied on the couch awake.
You want to put it in the past tense?
He used to lie on the
couch. Okay, thank you. He used to. His life was one in which he used to lie on his couch awake, wide-eyed, tearless, till dim daybreak. It's not that it happened once. He did it a lot. So the question is, what is he, and what does tearless mean here? So this is 3 out of 5. I mean, it's obvious what it means. He's not crying. But why does she say that?
It kind of maybe implies that he wants to cry, or but can't, or there's something that's kind of preventing him from, or there's some reason that he might be crying, but he's not.
Yeah.
Otherwise, why would you say it?
Yeah. That crying, in a way, and what she's getting out, getting right, and I think what she's getting out of her own experience, is that crying is a protest about the way things are that we learn as little children, because when we cry, we often get relief. Not it's a relief to cry, although it becomes a relief to cry, maybe. But crying is both, well, let's say it both seeks relief and is itself a relief. And one reason it's a relief is that our own experience as infants, as children, is that when we cried to seek relief, we often got it. So that crying then becomes its own promise that something will happen. But it's when you're tearless that can describe despair rather than describing the fact that you've been relieved. So we can see that all those nights, and we agreed that these are many nights now, right? That all those nights when he used to lie on his couch awake, wide-eyed, tearless, till dim daybreak, that was despair that didn't imagine a possible relief. And then never again will he smile and smile when his heart is breaking all the while. So, did that happen often? Yeah. Yeah. It is, again, it might sound a little bit to you like the narrator of Modern Love, the Meredith sonnet sequence. And then, so these are all things he used to do. He will never stretch out his hands in vain, groping and groping. So what did he used to do? Well, obviously, all of these things are what he used to do. Not what he did once, but what he used to do, what his life was like. Never again. Never ask for bread, get a stone instead. Notice the internal rhyme there. And she doesn't have to say again anymore. So what did he used to do? 1 out of 5. What did he used to do?
Constantly disappointed.
Okay, good. Yeah. Cut to the chase. Thank you. Yeah. Constantly disappointed. He would ask for bread. He'd get a stone instead. And what would he do then?
Pretend that it was what he wanted.
Yeah, even though it wasn't. So I think you can feel that this is erotic despair. That is, that if he's lying in bed all night with his eyes open, if his heart is breaking, which is probably the clearest indication, that this is erotic despair. His heart isn't breaking. Oh, you gave me a B minus on my paper. My heart is breaking would be excessive. If his heart is breaking, heartbreak always means something like you love, but you're not loved back. The person who used to love you no longer loves you. So that seems to be what he will never experience again. Never ask for bread, get a stone instead. Yes, we'll always be friends. So that's what tells you it's a metaphor, that he pretends that the stone is bread. It's not like this happens every day as he's hungry and someone gives him a stone and he says, oh, thank you, I'm going to really enjoy this delicious bread. It's that he says to her something like, I loved you so much. You're the most important person in my life. If only I could feel that you felt you had feelings for me. And she says something like, yes, we'll always be friends. You know, it's a difference. Are you too young to have watched Buffy or Angel? You've seen Buffy. Okay. Well, you know that there's a show. Angel had his own show later on. Did you know that? Yeah. So there's a point where Angel breaks bad, to coin a phrase, and the woman says to him, I love you. And she thinks that he loves her back, but no, he's broken bad, he's acting weird. And then his response to her is, love you. So that, in a nutshell, is asking for bread and getting a stone instead. When someone says, yeah, I love you, that's not I love you. It's really sad that it isn't, but that's the equivalent of what's going on here. I love you. Love ya. So that's what's happened to him. Never sway and sway twixt the false and true, weighing and noting the long hours through. Does she love me? Could she love me? Is what she did possibly something that I could take as love? Never ache and ache with the choked up sighs. This is the end of him. Here he lies. So again, ache and ache with the choked up sighs, not because he's hungry, but out of love. So just very quickly, how do we think he died? Okay, yes. Yeah, so that was 1 out of 5 too, right? It wasn't that he was walking along the bike path and someone on an electrified scooter that went too fast hit him. So it's all good. It seems to be an epitaph for a suicide, and she doesn't have to say that. That the very description of this person's life, which is not a description of all the great things that he did, which is what epitaphs, you know, pretended to hate cats but didn't, wagged his tail, liked everyone. You know, those are the good things about the dead person. This isn't a list of good things about the dead person. This is a list of the sorrows the dead person went through. And the good things about him are that he somehow managed to cope with those sorrows for a while, but only for a while. Yeah.
I might be reading too much into this, but
we never do that in this class.
Really deep. So I was thinking about why would he be lying on the couch crying? So first of all, he's wealthy enough to have a couch, not just a bed.
Uh-huh.
So that tells us something about him. And normally when you're not in bed crying, but you're somewhere else, it's because you don't want someone to hear you.
Uh-huh.
So he might be married to a woman that he doesn't love.
Nice.
And she's in bed, and so he's on the couch so that she doesn't hear him crying, or not crying, or he's getting some sort of space.
Okay, yeah.
To sit in that.
Just to say couch probably meant bed for her, but as in couché in French. The older use of the word couch is bed. But it is putting me in mind of the painting of Meredith as Chatterton, who's committed suicide, and he's lying on what we would call a couch there. Remember that painting that I think you were there that day. So we're doing Modern Love, and Meredith posed for a painting of the... This one, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Anyhow, go on.
Yes. Okay, in the top, Levy writes bed, when uh-huh. she says, on a commonplace person who died in bed.
Yes, okay.
So would she have, I mean, maybe she would have used couch mm-hmm. as bed. I'd find it weird that she would say couch in one part and then bed in another.
Uh-huh.
But beyond
okay,
that...
Okay, that's, yeah, okay. I'll, yeah.
Okay.
Nice.
He died in bed. Would he have killed himself in bed if he was married to someone? Like, that's kind of a weird place to kill yourself.
Unless you're... This is your last attempt to communicate with her.
I feel like it would just be really messy and, like, bad for her.
Yeah, that might
Why
be
Why wouldn't
the point.
He do it, like, in the bathtub or, like, by himself? Or, like, in the woods or...
I mean, dying sheerly out of heartbreak was also like a more common thing back then, right? So
you could so dramatic.
I mean, you could die from the ache and the choke of sighs. So
I just read it as he died in bed, like he was old and lived like this his entire life, and then he died, and that's that. And it says on a commonplace person. And I just think that she's trying to convey that this is just the life of many people. You live in despair and then you die.
Okay.
Rather than this is a big dramatic telling of a man who killed himself.
I also agree with that in some way. Like, my first interpretation was somehow this incredibly depressed person lived and did not commit suicide, and then gratefully he died. But I I kind of see it both ways. I'm also not, like, the biggest fan of, like, suicidal poetry.
Yeah.
But, like...
Well, okay, so I don't agree, but I think that's really interesting. And I think that maybe where we would overlap is a sense that that the very fact that the poet is, that she's calling him commonplace, means that she thinks this is what life is like. So it may not be that she is documenting a particular person's despair, which is how I was reading it, but that she's saying this is what it's like to be a human being, is that you have to do this, which makes it a document of her despair. That is, if she thinks this is what human life is like, you get a sense of her. So in a sense, in either way, it's a document of despair, and it may just be, the more minor question is, whose despair is it? Yeah, go ahead, Quinn.
On the one hand, again, like, I'm just fascinated by the idea of the second Jewish woman to go to Cambridge, and that's, like, what's interesting to me. I don't have a lot to say about this poem, because, like, I mean, I do, but, like, sometimes I get tired of depressed poets who want to make you depressed.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Are you tired and not liking the poem, or just...
I like the poem fine. I think it's, like, technically a good poem, and I see what you mean by if she had, like, lived. But at the same time, like, I was disappointed because when I heard for a second Jewish woman to
yes.
be Cambridge and a poet, I was like, paper. And then she killed herself and became deaf, and I was like, maybe not my paper.
Yeah, okay.
And I was... I think what I wanted to maybe ask about was, like, what her family's, like, situation was, or what her situation was that she got to that successful point in her, like, teens and 20s.
Yeah. Well, maybe paper. yeah, it's worth reading some other of her poems. So, you know, just Google her. It's, you know, I think Rick's... The poems Rick's picks in this anthology, Rick's picks in the anthology, they all tend to be interesting, but he also skips a bunch of interesting poems, and she has a lot of interesting poems. If I recall correctly, her mother died when she was, one source of difficulty in her life was the death of her mother when she was fairly young, although I can't remember how old she was now. But Yeah, you just, you know, spend 5 minutes on Wikipedia after your next class, not before, and see what you think. I didn't read the Wikipedia entry on her, but I'm sure it's, you know, it'll give you some interesting things that you could decide whether to pursue or not. Okay, let's look at Danny Deaver, page 539. Kipling's poem, Danny Deaver.
Page number?
539. Have people read Kipling? Is any Kipling?
Yeah, a little bit. A long time ago.
What did you read? Do you remember?
I've read Just So Stories.
Uh-huh.
I read at least part of... He was Jungle Book, right?
Yes.
And then I feel like there was something else of his that I read part of. Long time ago, again, like middle school.
Did you read If?
Yes.
I read If.
Yeah, not my favorite.
Yeah, I loved it in seventh grade. But
yeah, yeah, no.
Danny Deaver's probably better.
Yeah, no, If is quoted all the time as an inspirational poem. And he was not, he's not an optimistic person. Let's put it that way. His most famous phrase, unfortunately, is the white man's burden. So that's a well-known phrase. In context, it's actually different from what it sounds like, but not the opposite of what it sounds like. But different from what it sounds like. It's absolutely and definitely about the superiority of Western European culture. But it is a temporal rather than explicitly, it is racist, obviously, but it's that the way things worked out is that right now, white civilization is the most advanced civilization on the planet, and that it is the burden of the white man to help other civilizations to achieve the same attainment as European civilization. But he also had a lot of issues with English civilization, for example, and with European civilization in general. So the idea of taking up the white man's burden is the idea of seeing that there are people who are need the kinds of institutions that we have, let's say democracy, let's say social welfare, and so on. There are cultures that really need that if they are going to not be backward, is the way he would put it. And that's not quite the same thing as saying only whites can run the world and everyone else should shut up. It's not a Trumpist view. That is, you know, you can blame him fine and decide that even looking at Kipling at his, looking at him most charitably, he's still awful. I think that's a totally legitimate attitude to have towards him. But I just want to give you some sense of what his actual thinking is, which is different from, somewhat different from what he's always taken to be. His most famous poem is Gunga Din. Do people know that poem? Is that, I mean, you haven't read it, but do you know the story? It was made into a movie starring Cary Grant. So not familiar to people. So it's a story about, a British soldier in India in a battle. And one of the people, one of the servants is, a water carrier whose name is, he pronounced it Gunga Dean. It's spelled D-I-N, but pronounced Dean. And it is about this battle, and the soldier gets wounded. It's a really famous poem. It's a poem you should know. It tells a story, and it begins, "You may talk of gin and beer when you're quartered safe out here and you're sent to penny fights and older shot it. But when it comes to slaughter, you must do your work on water and you lick the bloomin' boots of him that's got it." So the idea is that when you're actually involved in slaughter, it's not like being here in England and drinking and just breaking up barroom fights. But if you're actually involved in a real war, a real colonial war, you have to do your work on water. When it comes to slaughter, you must do your work on water. And you lick the bloomin' boots of him that's got it. And then it goes, "Now in Inja's sunny clime, where I used to spend me time, a servant of Her Majesty the Queen," the queen would be whom?
Victoria.
"Of all them black-faced crew, the finest man I knew was our regimental Bishti, Gunga Din." So Bishti is a water carrier. And he's saying, of all the people who were giving us support, but also of all the people I was fighting on the side of, the finest man I knew was Gunga Din. So he is the person who's a carrier of water, and the story that he tells is the story of what makes Gunga Din morally superior, humanly superior to everyone else there, including the British troops and including their enemies and including everyone else. And Dean shows more courage, Gunga Din shows more courage and more self-sacrifice than anyone else. But so that's the story. It's worth reading, but it's a story about how he comes to realize that Gunga Din is the finest man he knew. And again, it's a very, very questionable poem, but it's not the poem that Donald Trump would write, if you can imagine such a thing ever happening, Donald Trump writing a poem. But it's not that. So that's that. But his other really, really famous poem is The Ballad of East and West. Does that ring a bell? So the just to tell you very quickly, the story of The Ballad of East and West, it's an amazing poem. But to tell you very quickly the story, there is a raider in what is now Pakistan, but at the time was just part of the whole, Greater India before partition. And his name is Camel, and he has raided the British controlled territory and stolen the colonel's mare, the colonel's horse. So it begins, there's a very famous opening, which is also the closing. "Oh, east is east and west is west, and never the twain shall meet till earth and sky stand presently at God's great judgment seat. But there is neither east nor west, border nor breed nor birth, when two strong men stand face to face, though they come from the ends of the earth." So the idea is almost Homeric, that these two figures confront each other, one from the east, one from the west, and they have a confrontation and they stand face to face. And the whole idea of East versus West, Occident versus Orient, and so on, all of that drops away when they acknowledge each other, which is what the poem is about. And then it tells a story. Camel is out with 20 men to raise the border side, and he has lifted the colonel's mare, which is the colonel's pride, and he has lifted the colonel's mare between the dawn and the day and turned the Calkins upon her feet and ridden her clear away. And then the colonel's son goes after Camel. And Camel leads him on a chase through his own territory. And the colonel's son fails to capture him, but Camel turns back and says, there wasn't a moment where I couldn't have had you killed, because every stone and every rock, this has already been established in the poem, had one of my men behind it. And if I had nodded, they would have shot you. If I had raised my hand, they would have shot you, but I didn't. And the colonel's son said, you may as well do it. I don't care, but be aware of what would happen to you if your men shot me. And the colonel's son calls him a jackal. And Camel is impressed by the colonel's son's courage. And they become friends. That's the very quick outcome of the story, is that from that confrontation, they become friends. And at the end, Camel says, thy father has sent his son to me. I'll send my son to him. And he whistles for his own son, who comes down, and he says, you should now essentially become a Gurkha. You should eat the White Queen's meat. And thou must eat the White Queen's meat. The White Queen being?
Victoria.
All right, good. So there's a kind of, it ends with an extraordinary picture of mutual respect. That's the two strong men face to face, so they come from the ends of the earth. However, the mutual respect is ultimately on the terms of the British, of the imperialists. So that is, I think, typical of Kipling when he is talking about the Raj, when he's talking about British command over India. He himself was born in India. What he is correcting among the British is a sense of their racial, even cultural superiority to the Indians. But what he's correcting among the Indians is a sense of the British as not showing actual respect for them. And, you know, whatever utopian idea he has, it's an idea where they would respect each other mutually, but ultimately on British terms. That is, that they could be as culturally advanced as the British are, which would be good for the British, because the British would be less imperialist if they were dealing with people they acknowledged as equals in India. So that's just a very quick and dirty sense of what is defensible about Kipling and what's indefensible about Kipling. Both. Yeah.
What did Victoria and Albert think of Kipling?
Albert was dead, but Victoria really, really liked him. But just to give you a sense of that, look at the poem, the funny poem called In the Neolithic Age, which is 541. So what this is about is that Tennyson died in 1891, and they were looking for, was it 1891? I think it was. They were looking for, see, all these questions that I now can't ask on the final, like when did Tennyson die, except maybe I can. They were looking for a new poet laureate. And, 1892, 1891 old style, that's what I'll say. They were looking for a new poet laureate. And there was a guy who is mentioned in this poem called H.D. Trail, who was a critic, and he was asked to compile a list of potential people to replace Tennyson as a poet laureate. And he listed 50 people. He said, these are all minor poets. There's no one like Tennyson. It's terrible. Swinburne was pretty good and still alive. But anyhow, no one liked Tennyson. It's terrible. And Kipling wasn't on that list of the 50 best poets, the 50 best poets in England, none of whom were that great, according to Trail. Kipling wasn't on that list. But then someone said to Trail, well, what about Kipling? And he said, oh, yeah, you know, the Ballad of East and West. That's the poem I was just telling you about. That's actually not so terrible a poem. And so he made Kipling number 51 on the list. He redrafted the list with Kipling as number 51. So then Kipling writes this poem, which I really quite like. It's funny but serious. In the Neolithic Age. So when's the Neolithic Age, anyone? What does that mean?
It's when I'm not too sure. Okay, but I guess that's one of the caveman eras.
Yes, so stone, lithic means stone.
Stone tools.
And Neolithic is the latest part of the Stone Age. So there's the Paleolithic, which is the earliest Stone Age, and that's when tools were basically, you took a rock and you broke nuts with a rock. And the Neolithic is when you had axes and things like that, when you could chip away at tools and make stone axes. But it's still way, way back in human time. So in the Neolithic age, savage warfare did I wage for food and fame and woolly horses' pelt. So the speaker is someone who in the Stone Age was engaged in savage warfare, just like now in something like Gunga Din. But when it comes to slaughter, you must do your work on water. So in the Neolithic age, savage warfare did I wage for food and fame and woolly horses' pelt. I was singer to my clan in that dim red dawn of man, and I sang of all we fought and feared and felt. So the speaker here was a singer, a poet, an oral poet, in the Neolithic age, at the dawn of man. Again, notice that this is picking up from what we've been talking about since Tennyson, which is the discovery of what has been called deep time. The discovery that the world went, geological discoveries that the world went way, 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 way back, that it wasn't 6,000 years old, that it went back millions of years. Interestingly, one of the questions that arose then, this is just a tiny little bit of history of science, but an interesting one, is that, do you know what Kelvin means when you give something in degrees Kelvin? So what does it mean?
Well, it's like the
all right, what's 0 degrees Kelvin? Okay, so what
we... Like form of measurement that's more commonly used in temperatures, like in science, than Fahrenheit or Celsius.
Yeah.
Because it's based on absolute zero.
Yes, 0 degrees Kelvin is absolute zero. Yeah. So do people know what absolute zero is?
When all the particles stop moving.
Right. So you can't get colder than absolute zero. It's an absolute limit to cold. And Lord Kelvin, who came up with the idea, also said, wait, the world can't be that old because look at the sun. We know roughly how big the sun is. There is no fuel that could burn more than 10,000 years that wouldn't burn out after 10,000 years, is what he was saying at the end of the 19th century. So that was the beginning of the discovery of a different way of producing energy, which Madame Curie very famously found, which is radioactive energy. So the sun was a huge puzzle. If the Earth was so old, how could the sun have been around that long? Why didn't it burn itself out? And the answer is that it's fusion rather than oxidation. So you learned something. Kipling is alive as these issues are, and he's young, but he is thinking about these issues. He's in his mid-20s when he writes this poem. He's thinking about these issues. And so the same thing that you get, the deep time that you get in Tennyson, nature doesn't care about the individual, only the species. But no, nature doesn't even care about the species. Look at the fossil record. Millions of species have gone extinct over the millions and millions of years that the Earth has been around. So here we're talking about Neolithic age is, let's say, 500,000 years ago, roughly, or 100,000 years ago, somewhere between then. In the Neolithic age, savage warfare did I wage for food and fame and woolly horses' pelt. I was singer to my clan in that dim red dawn of man, and I sang of all we fought and feared and felt, because that's what singers sing about. Yea, I sang as now I sing, When did he do that? When the prehistoric spring made the piled Biscayan ice packs split and shove. So he's talking about what happened when? When the Ice Age came. Sorry?
When there was an Ice Age.
Right. And the Ice Age was finally melting. So, and the troll and gnome and dwerg and the gods of cliff and berg were about me and beneath me and above. So all these maybe extinct figures, maybe superstitious figures. But arrival of Sultre told the tribe my style was outre. But arrival of Sultre told the tribe my style was outre. So Sultre was a Neolithic tribe. They were called or are called the Sultrans. So arrival of Sultre, another poet, told the tribe my style was outre, which that poet really didn't do. Too much in French. Excessive. Oh, how outre. Sultre is in France. That's where that tribe was. 'Neath a tomahawk of diorite, he fell. Diorite is a stone that was sometimes used for axe handles. So what does our speaker do? He kills a rival who doesn't like his poetry. So the rival complains about his poetry. Oh, it's too outre, so he kills him. And I left my views on art barbed and tanged below the heart of a mammothistic etcher at Grinnell. So I killed this guy who was etching, doing cave paintings of mammoths. And I left my views on art, I made it clear what I thought of his art, by killing him. Barbed and tanged below the heart, that is, with some weapon, I hit him below the heart and he died. Then I stripped them, the rival and the cave painter, scalp from skull, and my hunting dogs fed full, and their teeth I threaded neatly on a thong. So, you know, this poet is also a person of action. And I wiped my mouth and said, it is well that they are dead, for I know my work is right and theirs was wrong. So, you know, if you think poets are vicious to each other now, you can guess that they were even more vicious to each other at the end of the 19th century. But my totem saw the shame. That is his spiritual idol. From his ridgepole shrine he came, and he told me in a vision of the night. So he, the speaker, has a night dream. And what does his totem say? He says, there are 69 ways of constructing tribal lays, and every single one of them is right. That is, there are 69 different ways of doing poems. Don't think that there is only one. Every single one of them is right. So his superego comes to him in a dream and says, really, don't kill the rival poets. If you take a poetry workshop, you know, critique, be helpful, do it the way they do it at Brandeis. Don't think you have to kill everyone else in your poetry workshop, because that would be wrong. Maybe if Trump were a poet, I know, it's hard. Then the silence closed upon me till they put new clothing on me of whiter, weaker flesh and bone, more frail. So now he's become a modern, and a modern white poet. But notice that he's still the same person. But now he has whiter, weaker flesh and bone, more frail. And I stepped beneath time's finger, once again a tribal singer and a minor poet, certified by Trail. So because he's number 51 on Trail's list. So now he's become the modern Kipling, certified by Trail. Still they skirmish to and fro, men, my messmates on the snow, when we headed off the Oryx turn for turn. So the same people who were his messmates during the Ice Age, when they were heading off the aurochs, which are extinct cattle, they're still skirmishing. No change. When the rich Allobrogenses never kept amanuenses, and our only plots were piled in lakes at Bern. So the Allobrogenses were an Iron Age people. You know what an amanuensis is? It's someone who takes dictation. So it's a modern world, which is the word which has fallen out of use because people don't do that anymore, but Siri might count as an amanuensis. And our only plots were piled in lakes at Bern. That is when the Ice Age was ending and the plots of land they lived on were being flooded by the glacial lakes in Switzerland. Still, a cultured Christian age sees us scuffle, squeak, and rage. Still, we pinch and slap and jabber, scratch and dirk. So dirk is stab. Still, we let our business slide as we drop the half-dressed hide to show a fellow savage how to work. So we're no different from what we were in the Stone Age. Still, the world is wondrous large, seven seas from March to March, and it holds a vast of various kinds of man. And the wildest dreams of Q in London are the facts of Kathmandu. It's true. And the crimes of Clapham chased in Martaban. So Martaban is in Myanmar. And what in Clapham people think are crimes, in Martaban people think they're fine. Yeah, it's okay to be gay or to have sex without marriage. So, conclusion. Here's my wisdom for your use. As I learned it when the moose and the reindeer roared where Paris roars tonight, that is what I learned during the Neolithic Age, there are 69 ways of constructing tribal lays, and every single one of them is right. That is, all poetry from all cultures is equal. Poetry is poetry, and the idea that some culture has superior poetry to another, that some attitude towards poetry is superior to another attitude towards poetry, that's wrong. Poetry is great, and it doesn't matter what culture is producing it, who in that culture is producing it. So I think that's Kipling at his best, at his political best, let's say, at his cultural best. But it shows, it's not atypical of Kipling. And it still relies a little bit on the sense of, basically saying savages are just as good as us, but there's still, it's beginning with a distinction between us and savages. Even if it effaces that distinction, it's a distinction that he expects makes sense. So he's a poet at best to be ambivalent about. But we'll look at Danny Deaver on Wednesday. I think just dismissing him is being too crude about what he's like. So it's fine to dismiss him, but know what you're dismissing. Okay, see you Wednesday.